I'm Christopher Lydon with Chris Hedges, grim obituarist of our American empire, our democracy, our culture, our media, you name it. His new book recounts the death of the liberal class. This is open source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Chris Hedges, we can never say that you didn't warn us. In books like War is a Force That Gives Us Meaning and Empire of Illusion, which we were talking about a year ago. And I could never say that your warnings don't usually resonate with reality as I see it. George Carlin says many of the same things and makes us laugh in those YouTube clips when he talks about who really controls America. And he says, they own you and all that. Chris Hedges, you make us think about maybe a last chance to save the day. Or are we beyond saving?
Well, I suppose to stop resisting is to give up hope. To become passive or cynical is to wash our hands of it and say we're beyond saving, and I'm not there yet. But of course, the prognosis is very bleak, environmentally, economically, politically. We're very, very far gone, and we are entranced by electronic hallucinations. We're mesmerized by the celluloid shadows on the wall of Plato's cave. So it's certainly bleak.
Speak to the news of the day before we get into the book. First, this matter of tax cuts for the mega rich, and then the WikiLeaks fight over information and freedom and government transparency on the web. What does it say first about the fate of liberals and liberalism when President Obama, who ran against those top bracket tax cuts in 2008, is ready now to let Republicans have them?
Well, it's even worse than that because Obama freezes the wages of federal employees, which will save an estimated $5 billion. And yet he passes or the continuance of these tax cuts, which will cost us $900 billion. And it's just one more capitulation in 2 years of repeated capitulations to the oligarchic elite and the corporate state. And the Obama presidency is a referendum on bankrupt liberalism. On the failure of self-identified liberals and self-identified liberal institutions, including the Democratic Party, to do what they traditionally were designed to do.
What does that mean, a referendum on bankrupt liberalism?
Because everything that the Democrats and Obama have passed has betrayed the interests of working men and women in this country. Whether that's the so-called jobs bill, which ends up being $15 billion in tax credits for corporations, whether that's the so-called health care reform bill, which ends up being the equivalent of the bank bailout bill for the for-profit pharmaceutical and insurance companies, $400 billion in subsidies. And now we're watching this obscene granting of exemptions because these corporations don't want to provide medical coverage to chronically ill children, whether that's the refusal to restore habeas corpus, the continuance of our permanent war economy and the imperial projects which are doomed to failure in Iraq and Afghanistan, on and on and on. The rage that is being expressed through emotionally consistent but irrational movement such as the Tea Party is a legitimate rage. And that rage is not only directed at the centers of power in government but is directed at a liberal class that did betray the working class, that turned their back on the working class in this country and yet continues to speak in the traditional language of liberalism while abandoning the core values of liberalism.
What does it tell you that a number of liberal Democrats led by Nancy Pelosi in the Congress are saying no to the president on the tax giveaway?
Well, it doesn't matter. It's all political theater. Whether it's the outrage over BP, whether it's the outrage of the malfeasance of Wall Street, that's show. The actual mechanisms of government support the very institutions that have carried out fraudulent activity. I mean, there's no other way to describe what these large banks did. They sent mortgage brokers and bankers into low-income neighborhoods. They fabricated the information on loan applications. They knew the information was false, and they gave money to people they knew couldn't pay it back. And then they sold these things as derivatives or assets with AAA ratings. I mean, under any criteria, it's a crime. And yet we are watching them loot the U.S. Treasury and now attempt to monetize the debt to the tune of $600 billion. We have undergone a coup d'etat in slow motion, and it's over. They've won and we've lost.
Chris Hedges, what does it tell you that in all the discussion of the mega-rich tax cuts, they talk about stimulus to the economy, they talk about this margin or that percentage? What they never mention in the media, too, is that the underlying and really scary problem in this country is plutocracy, a huge widening gap in incomes, in ownership, in power between the top 2% and the rest of us. I mean, that never gets mentioned in these Obama stories.
Yeah. And they, you know, we judge economic indicators by the health of the stock market or the health of the speculative class in companies like Goldman Sachs, who engage in this kind of casino capitalism. Speculators in the 17th century in Europe were hung. Speculation was considered to be a crime. And we are reconfiguring American society into a very frightening kind of neo-feudalism. We're watching the thin sort of safety net that is provided to Americans get ripped out from under them with massive state and federal budget cuts. I mean, the next thing they're gunning for is Social Security, and they may get it.
Chris Hedges, touch down on WikiLeaks. It seems to me there are going to be big stakes here for any sort of informed democracy and free citizenship and free media in this question of punishing WikiLeaks for telling us the truth. And our media are divided on the question, as I'm sure you've noted.
Yeah, WikiLeaks does, you know, it's different from the Pentagon Papers in a very important way, in that Ellsberg actually had agreed to the kind of restrictions that are imposed on people who handle top secret information. He was inside the system and the RAND Corporation. This is a much more cut and dry issue of classic leakage by whistleblowers, you know, the ability to take documents and disseminate them to the public. And the broad-based assault against WikiLeaks is extremely frightening because what they are attempting to do with some success is essentially shut them off of the internet to starve their money. And to remove them from one site after another. And the big question is, you know, after they extradite, if they extradite Julian Assange to Sweden, will they try and extradite him to the United States?
Come back to the death of the liberal class in the title of your book. Who or what is the poster person or institution that is dying or dead? I mean, give us the who, what, when, where, and how, if you will.
You have roughly five pillars of the liberal establishment, five traditional mainstays of liberal institutions, which would be the press, public education and universities, culture, liberal religious institutions, and of course the Democratic Party. And we have watched a slow withering away of these institutions, I would argue since the First World War. On the eve of the First World War, powerful populist movements were threatening the grip of the power elite. We had strong anarchist syndicalist organizations like the Wobblies, a strong communist movement, a powerful CIO. And these people had a broad social vision. Eugene Debs polled a million votes. Some of the most important publications in the country, Appeal to Reason, the masses, very high circulation. And as Dwight MacDonald writes, the war was the rock on which they broke. The war was very unpopular. The pressure on Wilson to go to war came primarily from Wall Street and the banking class because they had lent tremendous sums to the British and the French, and they knew that if the Germans won the war, they wouldn't get their money back. Wilson had run for re-election on the slogan, "He kept us out of the war." When they declared war, they couldn't fulfill the recruitment drives, and they had to almost instantly institute the draft, and we saw the rise of the Committee for Public Information, or known as the Creel Commission, heavy input from Walter Lippmann, who becomes a very kind of dark figure at this moment, and the first system of modern mass propaganda, where not only did they cross disciplines, they had their own film division out of Hollywood, which pretty much paid for itself, making movies like Kaiser, the Butcher of Berlin. They had their own news division, Public Speakers Bureau, graphic artists. And they saturated the country with this. And some of the most poignant sort of observations of what happened are written by Randolph Bourne and Jane Addams, who are appalled at how not only are the masses seduced by this propaganda, but the intelligentsia is seduced as well. And those few holdouts who remain, like Debs, who ends up in prison by the end of the war, are crushed through the cruder mechanisms of the Espionage and the Sedition Act. But the most important thing about the Committee for Public Information is that it drew on the investigations and understanding of crowd psychology that had been done by Le Bon and Trotter and Sigmund Freud. They knew that people were moved not by fact or reason, but by emotion, what Lippmann calls the manufacturing of consent. And the moment the war was over, all of these people, including Edward Bernays, who was Freud's nephew twice over, go straight to Madison Avenue and start working for corporations and government. And the dreaded Hun becomes the dreaded Red. So that the wartime measures, like the Espionage Act and the Sedition Act, are used to shut down appeal to reason, shut down the masses, the Palmer raids, the deportation of Emma Goldman, and to institute what we have lived with ever since, and that is this kind of state of permanent war, this psychosis of permanent war.
Mm-hmm.
And none of the social and political theorists of the 19th century had grappled with this phenomenon, including Marx. When Marx writes about war, he writes about the Prussian War and he hopes the Germans win because that will bring the fruition of the worker German worker state closer to being. And in essence, what we had through this system of mass propaganda, which has been with us ever since, has quite effectively allowed huge segments, maybe even a majority of the masses, to in essence call for their own enslavement. And we saw at that moment the broad-based assault against popular radical movements like the Wobblies, who were destroyed after the war. Big Bill Haywood ends up in exile in the last 10 years of his life in the Soviet Union, which had kept the liberal class honest. With the breakdown of capitalism in the 1930s, we saw perhaps the last golden moment of the American liberal class, where you had figures like Roosevelt and his vice president, Henry Wallace, who responded to these massive sit-down strikes and the deprivation that were visited on tens of millions of Americans by the Depression, institute the New Deal. And we could have gone the other way. There were powerful industrialists like Henry Ford and others who were openly sympathetic to fascism. Fortune magazine had put Mussolini on the cover in 1934, praising the dictator for defanging labor unions and empowering industrialists. And that's how the liberal class works. It acts as a kind of safety valve. It provides within formal mechanisms of power channels by which the grievances of those outside the power elite can be addressed. And when it functions, it makes a civic democracy possible. Mm. And when it doesn't function, when it ossifies and dies as it has now, then you have essentially rage or angst or anger being expressed through these anti-democratic, irrational movements that we see embodied in groups like the Tea Party.
Chris Hedges, let's talk about the way the liberal system works in our time. From your book, I make a list of three types of liberals. There are the ascendant liberals, as you've just sort of defined them, the more or less conscientious ornaments of an essentially corporate and money-minded society, people who could be said to represent the virtue that is still possible in, say, the editor of the New York Times or the New Yorker magazine, people like Oprah, Warren Buffett is a perfect example, Tom Friedman may be one. Then the second group I'd call the banished liberals, good people who went too far and had to be discounted. Ralph Nader, Noam Chomsky, maybe Howard Dean, maybe Jerry Brown, about to be governor of California again, but will always be known in certain circles as Governor Moonbeam. Chris Hedges himself, I mean, you could be called one of those liberals who had to be sort of put in the fruitcake department. Richard Goldstone is another one, the South African judge who, hugely honored figure, but who came down hard in his UN report on Israel in Gaza 2 years ago. That's a whole class, and I want to know how people get there, including you. And then, of course, there are the immortal liberals who died but never caved. Randolph Bourne, you've mentioned, who fought World War I. I mean, he fought against it. George Orwell, supremely. Dr. King, Malcolm X, Dorothy Day of the Catholic Worker Soup Kitchens, the independent journalist that we love, I.F. Stone, And Julian Benda, the French writer who wrote in the 1920s about the treason of the intellectuals, which is what you're writing about too, meaning thinkers who, in his case, thinkers who descended to politics or party or causes or tribes. How does this work? And what are the routes back and forth to these different circles of liberalism?
I would classify the last group you mentioned, people like Benda or I.F. Stone as radicals, King, Malcolm X, because they always had an antagonistic relationship with power. And that is what defines the liberal class. They collaborate with the power elite, which is why liberals, or I suppose the figures that self-identified liberals hate the most, is not Glenn Beck, it's Noam Chomsky, because he constantly calls them out on this. And they function this way. They are allowed to critique the activities of the power elite. The classic sort of role of liberals was played out in the months before the Iraq invasion with the whole concept that David Remnick at The New Yorker or Bill Keller, who was then a columnist for The New York Times, when they identified themselves as reluctant hawks. It pains me. Michael Ignatieff did this as well. It pains me to do this. I don't like war, but it's a moral necessity. And so they give to the activities of the power elite a kind of virtue it doesn't have. They are allowed, as the war, for instance, in Iraq deteriorated, we saw the same thing in the aftermath of the Vietnam War, they're allowed to critique what was done wrong. We weren't prepared for the occupation. We didn't know an insurgent. But they are not allowed to critique the motives. They're not allowed to critique the goodness of the state itself. When they cross that line, they're pushed out. And then they either become liberal pariahs or essentially they enter this radical group that you mentioned, this third category of people who are always alienated from power. And I think that those groups who are alienated from power, people like a Chomsky at this point, a Nader, a Julian Benda, of course, who wrote the great work Treason of Intellectuals, all of these figures keep the liberal class honest because the liberal class works within those parameters. Not that there aren't people of conscience within the liberal class. And oftentimes people of conscience, and I spend a fair bit of time in the book writing about some of them like Sidney Shanberg, they won't give up on these moral imperatives. You know, they're obstinate, they remain true to them, and so they are eventually pushed from liberal ranks, as Shanberg was when he was pushed out of the New York Times for writing about not only the homeless, but writing about the real estate developers who were pushing ordinary New Yorkers out of apartments and turning it over to the rich.
Sidney Shanberg, of course, was the hero of the war reporting on Cambodia, the killing fields, played by Sam Waterston in the movie. But then, as you say, he ran afoul of real estate values as a New York Times columnist and editor. How does that happen? It could be said to be your story, too, of how a reporter crosses a line.
Well, I've spoken with Sidney about this because we both ran afoul of the same employer. We know the game. We know the choices that we're making. And there are unwritten rules by which one advances within these institutions. There are clear delineations, lines you don't cross. And a good reporter will constantly push up against those lines and always be a problem and always be a nuisance. But if they push long and hard enough, and they tackle a particular issue that is extremely sensitive, then they will be cast aside.
Hmm.
And that's, of course, what happened to both of us.
This, to me, is the fascinating core of your book, Chris Hedges. I wish you'd explain how it is that some liberals can screw up, Michael Ignatieff, say, in endorsing the war in Iraq, not only screw up, but then come back at you and say it was better to be wrong for the right reasons than like others to have been right for the wrong reasons. And he stays in the charmed circle of respectability and power. He may yet be the Prime Minister of Canada. But then on the other hand, how is it that other people like Sidney Shanberg, like you, can act bravely in character and still be put out to pasture?
Well, because standing up and denouncing the Iraq War was a very bad career move. Whatever disquiet you may have felt about the war, and the good careerists went along with it. And they became sort of anti-war critics, people like Frank Rich, who, if you go back and read his columns at the time, supported the war. When it becomes convenient to take a moral stance or at least the cost is lessened because there's more of a consensus for critique, then you can say the things that should have been said before. In that very lonely moment when you're deluged with propaganda and there is widespread support for an enterprise that you're critiquing, you know, makes you a pariah. And big liberal institutions don't like controversy. They posit themselves as sort of the moral conscience of the nation. I came out of the church, you know. I mean, the church is a perfect example of this. And yet, in fact, what they don't like is they want to retain that veneer of a moral conscience without the cost that an actual moral stance would take. That's the delicate game that the liberal class plays.
The contrasts are strange. I wish you'd juxtapose Tom Friedman with the case of Richard Goldstone, the South African judge on Gaza. Tom Friedman not only apologized for the war in Iraq all the way beginning to end, but then he went on, when it had gone south, he was on Charlie Rose advocating the war again as a sort of, in hindsight, a cautionary sort of sodomy rape of an Arab Muslim nation just to teach the world a lesson about terrorism. Fairly arbitrary lesson, but nonetheless. And he's still writing a column for the New York Times. Richard Goldstone, a Zionist, a Jew, came down hard in his UN report on Israel in Gaza 2 years ago and has been kind of set aside for that judgment. You write about both of those men and both of those cases, Chris Hedges. What was going on there?
Well, Friedman is sort of the poster child for how far we've descended. And that quote that you mentioned on Charlie Rose I include in the book because it's something that older traditional liberal pundits would have never said. It's this crude hyper-masculinity. He uses the phrase, suck on this, you know. And it was a brief window into the intellectual and moral bankruptcy that has gripped self-identified liberals. There is no real difference between Thomas Friedman and a conservative columnist. They all embrace preemptive war, globalization. And you bring up the issue of Goldstone. Well, Goldstone went after the line that you don't cross in the liberal establishment is to call Israel out on the war crimes that it commits against the Palestinians. You have a powerful establishment within the Israeli lobby that will start going after you. That is, you know, every I covered the Middle East for 7 years, and I was the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times. No one who covers the Middle East would have any disagreement with the kinds of things Goldstone wrote. We saw it. But if you cared about your career and you came back to institutions like the New York Times, you would never say that publicly because you would be swatted down as fast as Goldstone was swatted down. That is a classic example of parameters that the liberal establishment will not cross, and the price of crossing it is very well known.
Chris Hedges, when you write about the death of the liberal class, I wonder, frankly, if you're mourning above all the New York Times, which you worked for, and you still read, as I do, often in sadness, often in anger.
Yeah, I don't want to romanticize the New York Times. Abe Rosenthal ran that place for a long time. He's a pretty awful figure. I mean, I'm a product of liberal institutions. I come out of these universities. I come out of the church. When I worked for the New York Times, which is the premier liberal news organization. So I'm intimately aware of their limitations and always was aware of their limitations. But at the same time, I believe they do have a vital role in a civic democracy, and they're important. And many people of integrity can find a home within those institutions, maybe not permanently, but certainly long enough to make an impact. So yes, I mourn these institutions because with their loss, we have no way to ameliorate the suffering that has been visited upon tens of millions of Americans, the working class in this country, who have been thrust into a kind of permanent underclass. The fact that 2.8 million people were pushed from their homes last year because of foreclosures and bank repossessions, joined by roughly the same number this year. That's about 8,000 people a day being thrown out of their homes. The fact that 45,000 Americans die every year because they can't afford proper medical care, 1 in 4 children on food stamps. I mean, you know, it's on and on and on. And normally, a liberal institutions would not be tone deaf to that kind of suffering. Instead, they no longer function as they should within the society. And so this anger is being co-opted and used by proto-fascist movements and demagogues, people like Glenn Beck or Sarah Palin or the Tea Party. I watched it in Yugoslavia, very similar with the breakdown of Yugoslavia as many parallels to what's happening within American society. So that when that anger is expressed, it's not only expressed towards formal mechanisms of power like government, but for a bankrupt liberal class that speaks in values that they won't defend. And so you have an assault, a twin assault, not only against established structures of power, but against the very liberal values that make a civic democracy possible.
Just what do you mean by the parallels you can see between Yugoslavia in the 90s and the United States in 2010?
You had a weak center. You had an economic meltdown. That's what caused the war in Yugoslavia. It wasn't ancient ethnic hatreds. It ended with hyperinflation, 25,000%, wide-scale factory closures. The Yugoslav state owed $9 billion in debt that they couldn't repay. Nobody would renegotiate the loans. You saw these buffoonish figures like Radovan Karadzic and Slobodan Milosevic and Franjo Tuđman take over the airwaves. That's the first thing they did, and spew out the kind of hate talk that is disseminated throughout the United States through outlets like Fox News. And with that assault came a kind of ridiculing of a weak liberal establishment. You know, you and I were speaking before the show about Dostoevsky. This was Dostoevsky's obsession in both Demons and Notes from Underground. Notes from Underground is about the defeated dreamer, about the underground man who went to all the Obama rallies and chanted "Yes, we can" and believed in Obama, and then was betrayed and now retreats in cynicism into the underground and concedes that only fools and idiots assume power. That's what's happened. And the collapse of liberal institutions, in Dostoevsky's words, inevitably lead to a frightening kind of moral nihilism. In the case of Russia, it, of course, it opened the door for Lenin and the Bolsheviks, but we're no more immune from that. Now, we live in a period now of relative stability. But should, for instance, this monetizing of the debt, which is, in essence, just printing $600 billion in new money, should that not work? Most economists are arguing over whether or not it will work, but none of them argue over the fact that if it doesn't work, it could be catastrophic. Once currency collapses, then all bets are off, and there are virulent and powerful forces, which I saw in Yugoslavia, and I see them reflected within the American landscape. And first and foremost of that is our liberal institutions and a liberal class that no longer functions.
Chris Hedges, this side of that scope of collapse, there are problems of every size and shape on the American agenda. But I'd just like to focus on two and ask you, how do we approach them without an outspoken liberal class and conscience in the middle of our politics and media? One is this whole matter of permanent war. We seem to have backed into it. And then the second question . It seems to be hugely threatening to every idea we have of this country, is mega wealth, a gilded age, a gilded class created by conscious manipulations of the tax code. And it's never been tolerated before for very long in this country. Look at those agendas and ask, you know, if there are no liberals left or if the liberals aren't going to do it, how in the world do these nightmare scenarios play out? Permanent war and a rich man's America.
Although it's different from the Gilded Age, because we had huge industrialists, you know, railroad barons, this kind of stuff.
Vanderbilt, Morgan, Rockefeller, right?
Yeah, exactly. So that you could organize workers in the oil fields at great cost, but you could do it. Now, wealth is in the hands of speculators who believe in the fiction that money is real, in the sense that money can make money. Rather than actually making goods, making money. And we already saw one collapse, and all the bets are pretty good that we'll see another. They have ripped down trade barriers so that, as you say, essentially they create tax havens. So you have a company like Halliburton, which is a parasitic entity. It feeds off of taxpayer money, and yet it sets up almost all its subsidiaries in Dubai, so it itself doesn't have to pay taxes. Corporate capitalism is something we've not seen before. To go back and quote Marx, unfettered capitalism becomes a revolutionary force. And what they have done is hollow the country out from the inside. They have created a system of global neo-feudalism. So now you're seeing large-scale factory closures over the border in Mexico as these factories pack up and leave for the embrace of China's cut-rate totalitarian capitalism or Vietnam. And the message that is being delivered to the American working class, which is a dispossessed working class at this point, is you have to be competitive in the global marketplace, which means you have to be competitive with prison labor. Capitalism, the penny capitalism that typified the farm town where I grew up, where farmers brought their goods in and sold it, is one form of capitalism. The regional capitalism of the local factory owner or hardware store owner is another form of capitalism, both of which are not destructive to a liberal democratic state. But corporate capitalism is. Corporate capitalism inevitably cannibalizes the host state itself, and that's where we are. And because the political parties are hostage to corporate capitalists, there is no way for us to fight back. There's no way for an American to vote against the interests of Goldman Sachs. And
are you sure? Yes.
I mean, if you look at a litany of legislation that's been passed by the Democrats, none of it had broad popular support. The first bailout bill was opposed across the political spectrum, $700 billion. The FISA Reform Act, which retroactively made legal what is illegal under our Constitution, and that is the warrantless wiretapping and monitoring of tens of millions of American citizens. The inability to staunch the suffering that is caused by foreclosures. I mean, they won't be – Obama won't push through a moratorium. The refusal to restore habeas corpus. We don't count. The levers of power have been so corrupted by the corporate state that we're impotent. We don't have any control now over what's happening to us, and both parties are culpable.
What control might we have on the matter of permanent war?
Well, that's part of the problem you see within the Tea Party, the irrationality of the Tea Party movement and these sort of groups that are now this lunatic fringe of the Republican Party. They talk about how they, you know, get government off our backs and government's part of the problem. But the militaries, they support the military as if the military is not part of government. It consumes half of all discretionary spending, the armaments industry. They talk about supporting tax cuts, and yet they want to reduce the deficit and create a balanced budget. At the same time, nobody is standing around talking about dismantling Social Security or Medicare or unemployment benefits. And this irrationality is typical within societies that no longer function. It's the irrationality of the ethnic Serb or Croatian movements that I saw leaping up around Yugoslavia, where suddenly the economic collapse is blamed on the opposing ethnic group. If you're a Croat, it's because the Serbs are stealing all our money. If you're a Serb, it's because we're subsidizing the Kosovar Albanians and all the Muslims in Bosnia. And you find within this right-wing fringe movement the same kind of hunting for scapegoats, undocumented workers, Muslims. Very, very similar echoes. It has an emotional resonance and an emotional appeal. It's quite effective at channeling and directing hatred, but it doesn't make any sense. And at that point, then your political configurations become very dangerous. They did a poll of the incoming members of Congress who are associated with the Tea Party movement, and I think it was 100% or if not, it was very close to it, don't believe that global warming exists. And the environmental crisis is intimately twinned with the economic crisis because corporate capitalism turns everything into a commodity, human beings into a commodity, the natural world into a commodity that it exploits until exhaustion or collapse. And that's precisely what's happening. They are not only willing to kill the nation state, but they will kill the ecosystem in the name for profit on which human life depends. And we're sitting here watching the farce of Cancun just as we watch them shred Kyoto and Copenhagen, as if we have endless amounts of time to react.
Chris Hedges, we keep talking about Julian Bender and his book from the 20s, The Treason of the Intellectuals, he set a kind of pure standard not only of abstract ideal thinking and independence from the world of give and take of politics. Engaged intellectuals have become the fashion, and now you say they're mostly kept intellectuals. Who are we looking for? And what's the kind of figure? Where might we find it to lead us with something like clear, classic, true thinking that might set a standard?
Well, all correctives to our democracy came from movements that clung fast to moral imperatives and did not compromise on those moral imperatives, whether that was the Liberty Party that fought slavery, the suffragists, the labor movement, the civil rights movement. And we forgot that reform never came from the top down. As Zinn always reminded us, it comes from the bottom up. We placed our faith in a Democratic Party that has for almost two decades now betrayed the very values, the core values of liberalism. And I think that we have to recognize that if we're going to rebuild or protect what is left of our anemic democracy, we are going to have to step outside the mainstream and not compromise on those values, not compromise with the Democratic Party. Because if we continue to do so, not only will we become objects of ridicule, which we largely are, but we will empower the very proto-fascist, lunatic fringe elements that we already seen leaping up around the fringes of the American political establishment. It is not our job to take power. Karl Popper, you know, said it best in The Open Society and Its Enemies. The question is not how do you get good people to rule. That's the wrong question. Most people attracted to power, as Popper points out, are either mediocre, which is Obama, or venal, which is Bush. The question is how do you stop the power elite from doing as much damage to you as possible? And we've been asking the wrong question.
Where did Karl Popper think we'd find real voices for this crisis?
Outside of the power elite. I mean, that whole first volume is an attack on Plato and the idea of the elect class. You know, that whole book is sort of a rant against placing your faith in great and wise and noble figures, but rather placing your faith in broad-based movements that are able to express in opposition to power popular will.
I place so much faith in the internet, unlike you. To me, it's still a waiting free venue for millions, billions of voices speaking freely.
Well, the moment that messages disseminated on the internet connect with any kind of broad-based popular support, you can be sure that the forces of control will do to those sites what they've done to Julian Assange. I watched it in Belgrade. We had under Milosevic a dissident radio station, B-52, and a magazine called Vreme, which means truth in Serbian. And they, in the magazine, you know, make Milosevic look like Hitler and this kind of stuff. And every time diplomats would come in, he'd say, look, I have a free press. Listen to B-52. Listen, look at Vreme. Well, the moment the street protests began in Belgrade, Vreme and B-52 got shut down instantly. There is no popular uprising. There is no popular discontent. And so to express opinions like mine are not threatening to the power elite. But the moment they become threatening to the power elite, then the power elite has the mechanism to shut them off.
I'm still in love with the idea of semiotic democracy, of end users out there typing away on the internet, or even of the idea that the second superpower out there, the people on the web, will raise their beautiful head and take over one day.
Well, the problem with the internet is people, first of all, retreat into ideological ghettos where they reinforce their own belief systems. The second problem with the internet is that it is destroying a craft or trade that you and I care very much about, and that's called reporting. With the death of newsprint, we're losing a whole cadre of people who are trained to go out, report stories, edit them, write them, have them fact-checked, and being published. And the end result was to build a public discussion around verifiable fact. When we lose those skills of reporting, all discussion becomes, from the left to the right, emotionally driven. Verifiable fact no longer becomes the foundation of public discourse. And I think the internet contributes to that.
Chris Hedges, you deliver so much bad news in beautiful style in this book, Death of the Liberal Class. Also, I must say, in your column, which I read all the time in Truth Dig, it's almost exhilarating, Chris. You're not enamored of disaster, are you?
No. You know, because I come out of – I spent 20 years as a war correspondent in collapsing societies. It's not theoretical. I know how they go down. I've seen them go down. And so – and I can envision what those societies look like when they go down. We didn't use words like pessimist or optimist as war correspondents. We made very cold assessments of what weapon systems were at the end of that road and what the capacity of those weapon systems were to do us harm, and we reacted. I don't think we can talk about hope if we can't grasp reality. If we are responding to self-delusion or an illusion of who we are and what we are, then hope becomes a meaningless word. If we are able to coldly confront what's out there, then hope becomes possible.
Chris Hedges, it's a privilege to read you. It's a great privilege to hear you and engage with you on Open Source. Thank you for your work. Thank you for this conversation.
Thanks for having me.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Lydon. Thank you for being part of the conversation.